A call for emergency legislation to help Gardaí deal with house parties makes the front page of the Irish Examiner. Residents in Cork City have urged the government to act as they protested near UCC yesterday to highlight their concerns after hundreds of young people attended a series of house parties and rented properties in breach of public health guidelines. Chief Superintendent Barry McPolan said Gardaí have contacted a number of the landlords and that warnings have been relayed to tenants. He appealed to the young people involved to behave responsibly. Over 70s will be able to invite people into their homes for the first time in months from next week. That's according to the lead story by Philip Ryan in the Irish Independent. Children and adults will be told that they must wear masks and gloves while visiting and stay strictly 2 metres away from the person who is cocooning. The National Public Health Emergency Team is also considering lifting the ban on playgrounds to ease the burden on children. Playgrounds weren't due to reopen until the 29th of June, but the report says that may be brought forward to next week, under the condition that the facilities are supervised and cleaned regularly. The Irish Times leads with HSE figures which show that more than 200 people contracted COVID-19 while admitted to hospital for other conditions or treatment. Jack Lambert, Professor of Infectious Diseases at the Mater and Rotunda Hospitals, told the paper that lessons have been learned since March about the spread of the virus, and he said the risk of infections in hospitals is now low. There's also a report that a third of people coming into the country are not answering the phone to officials checking if they are self-isolating. All talk and no trousers is the headline in the Irish Daily Star's top story. The paper details what it describes as an embarrassing episode involving MEP Luke Ming Flanagan, who appeared on a European Parliament video call in his underwear. He joined the Zoom meeting from his bedroom in Roscommon, saying he'd just returned from a run and put a shirt on to look respectable. He didn't appear too concerned though, commenting, "What's a pair of legs at the end of the day?" The Irish Daily Mirror reports in a story that you may have seen on RTE News last night. The family of a woman who spent 6 weeks in ICU battling COVID-19 were overjoyed as they welcomed her home. Laura Barry, who's 58, had been dubbed a medical miracle by staff at Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital in Drogheda. The paper also carries comments from Brendan O'Carroll that he's confident the Christmas specials of Mrs. Brown's Boys will be filmed as planned in October, although he's unsure if it'll be possible to have a live audience present. The Herald covers the story of a sinkhole which appeared in the middle of Dawkey Village in Dublin yesterday. The hole appeared suddenly as the tarmac on Castle Street fell away. It emerged later that a collapsed sewer pipe had caused the damage. On government formation talks, Juno McEnroe in the Examiner reports that the Taoiseach told his parliamentary party last night that if Fianna Fáil and the Green Party do not agree to reduce the state's debts while in coalition, then maybe it's best not to go into government with them. We're told that the warning came as the coalition talks hit shaky ground over climate action, pension reforms and transport. The Irish News carries condemnation from local representatives and Gardaí of widespread littering of beaches at Inishowen and Donegal over the long weekend. And the Belfast Telegraph reports that the public are being asked to help with a memory project to create an archive of life during the pandemic and ensure the story is preserved for future generations.
Protests have been continuing in cities across the United States more than a week after the death while in police custody of African-American man George Floyd. The killing in Minneapolis has unleashed deep-seated anger over policing and racism in America, with President Trump threatening to bring U.S. troops onto the streets for the first time in decades. Democrats have been criticizing his response to the crisis in what is a highly charged political atmosphere just months ahead of the presidential election. Let's talk to our regular contributor on U.S. affairs, Bob Schmuel, Emeritus Professor of American Studies at the University of Notre Dame. Very good morning to you, Bob, and thanks once again for taking our call this morning.
Good morning, Brian.
Can we talk about Donald Trump's response to this crisis to present himself, and I quote his own words earlier this week, as the law and order president? In the eyes of many people, somebody who's dialing up tensions rather than dialing them down. Is that fully explained by the impending presidential election?
I think certainly in large measure it is. And to say that he wanted to change the channel from all of the consideration of the coronavirus situation would be an understatement. And he saw this as an opportunity for him to show leadership. And instead of doing what most presidents would do, which would be to calm the waters and try to console the nation, He thought that it would be better for his own political purposes to divide and to use incendiary rhetoric.
The latest national polls continue to suggest, as one, I think, today from Reuters Ipsos, a national lead in the presidential campaign for the Democrat, presumptive Democrat candidate, Joe Biden. But of course, we know the US presidential election is not a national poll. Donald Trump and Joe Biden will be fighting for those crucial swing states. So how's all that playing out, do we know, in those crucial battleground states?
What we know, Brian, is that most of the polling that would be available right now concerning those states show that Biden is ahead in places like Pennsylvania and even Florida, Michigan, elsewhere. And Donald Trump is seeing those polls. And he made a sort of firm resolution on his part that he would run a base first and a base only strategy. And that means that he would go to people who would be like-minded to him. He's not spreading out his support. He's not widening it. He's deepening it. And they are trying to find people who would be sympathetic to his views and who might not have voted in 2016, and they want to bring them out to the polls in those key battleground states in November.
And is there, Bob, here a political precedent? Because the U.S. presidential election in 1968 was also fought against the backdrop of race riots and was seen, I think, then and since to have perhaps boosted Richard Nixon's campaign, maybe even secured him the White House. Is that the playbook that Donald Trump and his advisors are seeking to emulate?
Absolutely. And all one has to do is look at Donald Trump's Twitter feed. And just over the last several hours, you will see him tweeting out two words, silent majority, which those of us of a certain age remember as a phrase that rang around the Nixon campaign. And he's also tweeting out law and order. And back in 1968, Richard Nixon became the law and order candidate. But what's different between 1968 and 2020 is that Donald Trump is the president, and he can use the military, he can use the Department of Justice, he can use all of the arms of the federal government. Back in 1968, Richard Nixon was just a candidate who went around the country and saying that he would bring law and order to the country if he were elected instead of Hubert Humphrey.
What about the Democrats' response to this? I think it's pretty clear that Joe Biden's campaign has been hampered by the pandemic. How are the Democrats going to confront this?
They're confronting it in just the opposite way from Donald Trump. By that I mean they're talking about conciliation, reaching out, trying to calm the waters. You have Joe Biden meeting with religious leaders, talking with them. He spent a couple hours the other day with them versus Donald Trump walking over to the church and holding up a Bible, never speaking even to the people responsible for the church where he went. So that you have that sort of split-screen reality going on. You also have a situation which I think we should all watch, which is that Barack Obama, who has been beaten up over and over again by Donald Trump over the past few years, coming out and saying things about the George Floyd killing, about other matters, I think the extent to which he becomes involved in the 2020 campaign will be important to watch.
Very good. Bob Schmuel, as ever, thank you indeed for talking to us.
The deaths of 8 more people from coronavirus have been reported in the last 24 hours here, bringing the current toll to 1,658. Health authorities will meet tomorrow to decide whether to recommend a further easing of restrictions on people's movements next week. Later, we'll hear about how Italy, one of the hardest hit countries by COVID-19, is reopening its borders today. And we'll also talk to a GP in Monaghan after a day where she saw several of her patients test positive for the virus. At the latest briefing, the Chief Medical Officer, Tony Houlihan, said that the large crowd who gathered in Dublin at the weekend to protest against racism in the US posed a risk to life.
In general terms, look, we're still clear that the advice now is not for mass gatherings to take place, whether indoors or outdoors. Any mass gatherings we think now would at this point in the, let's say, phased easing of measures be simply too early. I would be advising anybody who's contemplating organising a mass gathering for whatever reason that now is not the time. And for people who are contemplating attending such events, and we understand people's, let's say, motivation and the emotions that might have been involved for people in relation to some of the events that took place over the weekend, I don't want to not recognise that. But our public health advice has not changed.
That's Dr. Tony Houlihan. Let's speak to our health correspondent, Fergal Barrett. Good morning again, Fergal. What else did he have to say about the gathering?
Well, we saw a number of Dublin protests on Bank Holiday Monday. I was at the Department of Health preparing for a live at Baggot Street, and the numbers were significant. Now, the Chief Medical Officer, he actually had no advice regarding protesters per se. He wasn't targeting any particular issue that way, but he was saying in general terms, the public health advice remains against mass gatherings, indoor or outdoor. And he said this is no time to be organising any such mass gatherings.
Eight more deaths, but the smallest number of reported cases since before the schools closed. Are these patterns a reflection yet on the easing of restrictions over 2 weeks ago?
They are, certainly. The initial lifting of restrictions came into effect over 2 weeks ago, and up to 14 days is the incubation period. So the figures we're seeing now and for the next few days reflect the impact, if any, of phase one lifting of restrictions. Just 10 new cases reported yesterday. You have to go back 12 weeks for a similar figure. Now, there can be a time lag after a bank holiday weekend in case reports. So, you know, you could see an increase in figures today, but these figures are very, very low.
Over 20,000 tests carried out over the last week. Who's being tested and where?
Well, we know that of the 500 confirmed cases over the last week, they're actually spread across 21 counties, and over half of them are in 24 to 55 year olds. So that's not nursing homes, and it's, you know, we're not really seeing much from the meat factories. So it's a mix of community and also close contacts. The National Public Health Emergency Team, they're going to meet on Thursday. They'll look at testing and the possible widening of testing criteria. But if you see that just 22,600 tests were done in the past week by the HSC. They have the capacity for 100,000 a week, we're told, but that capacity hasn't been tested. Now, the turnaround times are good at the moment, but if you did have to do 100,000 tests a week, what would the turnaround times be then? And what impact would longer turnaround times have? We'd only find the answer out to that if we got, hopefully not, a second wave, which isn't inevitable.
While the testing and tracing, as you said, Fergal, is getting faster, there's still a delay on people looking for a test.
There is 47% of people are taking longer than 4 days from the onset of symptoms to being swabbed. So yes, last night the health officials were strongly encouraging people to know their symptoms and seek medical attention as soon as possible and not delay. That is important.
What was said about relationships, intimate relationships, between people who don't live together?
Well, Dr. Houlihan said that the resumption of intimate close contacts between people who live in different houses, that's not part of the National Public Health Emergency Team guidance and advice currently. And he said the transmissions of any infection can happen as a result of close intimate contact. The HSC advice has been to only be sexually active with someone you live with who doesn't have COVID-19 or the symptoms.
The meeting tomorrow of the National Public Health Emergency Team, Fergal, where they will decide what to do, whether to recommend to government, whether to lift the restrictions next week. It's widely expected now that they will move on to phase two, isn't it?
Yes, it's a decision obviously ultimately for Cabinet on Friday, but everything points in the direction of phase two lifting. But, you know, phase two lifting isn't opening an awful lot. I mean, for example, people will look at what's happening in France at the moment. The cafes and the bars are open inside and outside. We see summer scenes in other countries, people enjoying life, albeit keeping social distancing in place. In Ireland, we have to wait until July 20th, still a very long way away, before the no unnecessary journeys is lifted and a small number of places are opening. It's August until officially pubs, bars and theatres open. Can that be sustained while the summer continues and the summer comes probably towards an end? So some people will ask, are we going too slow? Can this happen faster to revive the economy, lift spirits, people's mental health, but all the while strictly monitoring to ensure there are no spikes and having to take action if there is. But there will be much growing pressure, I think, now to move along on the phases, given that the time period that we have mapped out in this country is still an incredibly long time period ahead for people to contemplate.
Fergal, thank you. That's our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers.
It wasn't a surprise to you anyway that this vote by the Northern Ireland Assembly to extend the deadline for Brexit beyond the 31st of December, not a surprise to you that that was carried.
It wasn't a surprise, no. There's a solid majority now in the Northern Ireland Assembly. First of all, it's pro-Remain, but in a sense that's not relevant anymore because, as I said yesterday, we've moved on from that debate. But it was clear that there was a majority against crashing out at the end of this year. And I'm glad what's called the petition of concern isn't used, which is a sort of veto device that allows a cross-community consent mechanism to be brought into force. That's been used, as you know, vexatiously in the past in the Northern Ireland Assembly. It wasn't used yesterday. And really what yesterday did was show that the voice of the Northern Ireland Assembly, if you like, which has been silent for many years, actually it was silent, frankly, throughout the whole Brexit process from before Article 50 was triggered until after the UK ratified the withdrawal agreement. Well, our voices being heard again, and Boris Johnson and indeed Michael Gove and many others in the UK government said repeatedly they wanted the Northern Ireland Assembly to be back up and running so that we could give our views on Brexit and our voice could be heard. And indeed they insisted on that being written into a withdrawal agreement.
Right, but on the other hand, Brexit is a matter for the Westminster Parliament. That's where sovereignty in this issue lies. So beyond expressing the view and having your voice heard, what's actually, or is there any practical effect or impact from this?
Well, you're right, it's a non-binding motion, Brian, but it's not quite right to say that we aren't relevant, and this has been something that people have tried to imply. I've been saying really clearly that the Northern Ireland Assembly is a named party to the withdrawal agreement. That's different from, it's different from Scotland, it's different from Wales, it's different even from Dáil Éireann, Brian. No other devolved legislature in the UK, in fact, no other sovereign parliament in Europe is mentioned in the withdrawal treaty other than the Northern Ireland Assembly, and that's because the UK government insisted that the Northern Ireland Assembly should have a consent mechanism. We would have a say on the protocol. Mm-hmm. They insisted that our voice should be heard in the withdrawal treaty, so I think it's not reasonable. I don't think you can turn around then and say, well, it doesn't matter what we say about the Brexit transition. One bit, our voice is really essential and critical and completely indispensable on one bit of Brexit. But when we say another thing, we don't want to crash out in the middle of the biggest global health pandemic in anyone's lifetime, that we shouldn't be heard and it's irrelevant.
By the same token, then, should the voice of the Northern Ireland Assembly be heard on the issue of abortion and the vote by the Assembly opposing the new abortion regulations for Northern Ireland, that too should be honoured and respected?
Well, look, I said yesterday that it was legitimate for people to bring the debate to the Northern Ireland Assembly. I voted against the DUP motion, and I'll vote against any similar motions that are brought before the Assembly in any legislative attempt to roll back on women's rights. As I said, it's entirely legitimate for people to bring motions to the Northern Ireland Assembly and to debate them. I made my position on that clear yesterday. It's not, I don't think we should be about rolling back women's rights anywhere on this island, frankly, Brian. The DUP motion sought to do that. There was a Sinn Féin amendment which would also have, I think, muddied the waters and started to whittle away at hard-won rights for women in terms of health care. So while it's fine for people to bring their motions in front of the Northern Ireland Assembly, that's a legitimate thing for people to do now that we've restarted those institutions, and that's what I did yesterday with the Brexit extension motion. I'm going to oppose any attempt to roll back those rights.
Matthew O'Toole of the SDLP, thank you very much indeed. And so time to catch up on the business headlines this Wednesday morning with Adam McGuire. Good morning, Adam.
Morning, Brian. Drinks Group C&C has reported a 14.6% rise in operating profits for the year to the end of February, as revenues rose by almost 8%. The owner of Bulmers and Tennent's made a €120.8 million profit on the back of a €1.72 billion in revenue. The results also included exceptional items of €92.5 million, more than half of which directly relates to COVID-19, the company said. Video conferencing service Zoom says it expects sales of $1.8 billion this year, roughly double what it forecast in March. Use of Zoom has skyrocketed since COVID-19 related restrictions were imposed around the world. User numbers rose 30-fold in April, with 300 million people online at the same time at one point. And a California law firm has launched a class action lawsuit against Google relating to the private browsing feature on its Chrome web browser. The feature allows people to browse the web without details being saved on their computer, wherever Google's own ad trackers continue to log the user's activity, which the complainant alleges amounts to covert and unauthorized data collection. It says millions may have been affected by this and is seeking $5 billion from the technology giant. Finally, for now, the currency markets. 1 euro buying you 89 pence sterling and $1 and 12.1 cent.
A judicial review of a decision by Revenue to issue a tax bill of €1.64 billion to pharmaceutical company Perrigo is to begin before the Commercial Court today. The case focuses on what Revenue claims was the underpayment of tax arising from the sale by drug company Elan of its multiple sclerosis drug Tysabri to Biogen in 2013. Our business correspondent Will Goodbody is with us. Will, before we talk about this case, tell us about Perrigo.
Yes, good morning, Gavin. It's not exactly a household name here, but some of its products would be. Perrigo is an Irish registered and headquartered company that makes a variety of both over-the-counter and generic medicines and personal care products, like, for example, Salpidine and Nicotin. Its shares are listed on the New York Stock Exchange and in Tel Aviv, and it does most of its business in the US and doesn't manufacture here, but it does have its corporate headquarters in Dublin and employs around 160 people here. Last year, it had sales worth around $4 billion, so certainly not one of the largest players in the pharma market, but not small either.
So what's this case all about?
Well, in 2013, Perrigo agreed a deal to take over the Irish-based pharmaceutical company Elan for $8.6 billion. It was a so-called inversion move that was beneficial from a tax perspective for Perrigo, which at that time was based in the US. 8 months earlier, though, Elan had sold its intellectual property interest in the Tysabri drug for multiple sclerosis to a partner firm, Biogen. Now, that deal was done through a combination of an upfront payment and a promise of future royalty payments from Biogen that were dependent on the level of sales of Tysabri. So when Perrigo bought Elan, it effectively bought the fruits of that deal. But 5 years later, in 2018, Revenue issued this tax assessment on Perrigo, effectively seeking the payment of €1.64 billion in taxes, which it claimed had been underpaid arising from the Tysabri deal. Like all tax matters on this scale, it's pretty complicated stuff. But in essence, Perrigo had been treating those royalty payments for Tysabri following the sale of the drug and its intellectual property as trading income in the years after the deal. And as a result, it had been paying tax at the 12.5% rate, but Revenue said it should have been treating the payments as a chargeable gain instead and paying tax at the much higher rate of 33%. So in essence, Perrigo was being asked by Revenue to make up that difference.
What has Perrigo got to say about all of this?
Well, Perrigo denies it has done anything wrong here. It almost immediately appealed the decision to the Tax Appeals Commission, but that appeal would have focused on the quantum of the tax owed, not the question of whether tax was due at all. So a stay has been put on that appeal while Perrigo applied for a judicial review of the actual tax assessment by the High Court. And that's what's beginning today in the Commercial Court. That's the commercial fast track arm of the High Court. In earlier parts of the proceedings, lawyers for Perrigo argued that the company had conducted its business here for many years on foot of a certificate from the Minister for Finance under the Taxes Consolidation Act, and the company therefore had, and this is the key word, a legitimate expectation that the sale of the intellectual property would attract the same corporate tax it had been paying unchallenged for almost 20 years. As a result, it's expected Perrigo will argue the assessment issued by Revenue against it is in breach of the public law and should be quashed. Obviously, though, it's expected that Revenue will strongly argue against that when the matter comes before the court today.
What's the significance of all this then, Will?
Well, obviously, in the first instance, there's a lot of money at stake for both Perrigo and for revenue. And I suppose it goes without saying that 1.6 billion euro would be useful for the Exchequer to have right now. There are also a number of investors in Perrigo who are unhappy about this situation and its implications for the company. But separately, there will, I think, be a number of multinational companies and other firms who deal in high-value intellectual property who will be watching the outcome of this case very closely, both in terms of past deals, perhaps, but also in terms of future ones. Although I think given the size of the amount of money at stake, no matter what the outcome of this judicial review, appeals are likely to follow. And even if Perrigo does lose in the end, it's likely that it will reinstigate the proceedings at the Tax Appeals Commission and have that tax bill assessed. And some tax experts have already speculated that in such an event, the bill could end up being reduced quite significantly before all of this is over.
Will, thank you. That's our business editor, Will Goodbody. 7:40.
One of our greatest pipers, the late Liam Óg O'Flynn, playing there Slieve na Mban. Well, as we know, COVID-19 has had a huge impact on musicians through cancelled performances, postponed touring and significant loss of income for many. However, the world of Irish piping is adapting. Gay McKeown is CEO of the Society of Irish Pipers. He says the popularity of the handmade pipes and the enchanting music they make has not been diminished by the pandemic. And he's on the line now to tell us how and why. Gay, a very good morning to you and thanks for talking to us this morning.
Thanks, Brian. Good morning.
I'm told by one of my colleagues here that piping was almost a lost art if you go back 40 or 50 years. And it was really only saved and revived by people like Seamus Ennis and others handing down their knowledge and their skill to another generation face to face, sitting there in the kitchen or the living room and imparting the skills they had. And of course, that just can't happen at the moment, can it?
No, unfortunately, that can't happen in person, obviously, but there's a lot that we're doing. It's a very complex instrument, the Uilleann pipes. So, as you say, it was almost facing extinction. And, it was mainly predominantly played by Irish people and Irish people who emigrated to US and UK, Australia, etc. And now, all around the world, there are many people playing them, many of them without any Irish heritage whatsoever. So the whole world of Uilleann piping, although it's a very close community, it's a complex instrument, there's an international dimension to it. So we've support a lot of players through mentoring them and providing online resources.
And
so the international participation is really important. So the online services are critical.
Yeah, and that constant mentoring, the nurturing of the tradition, that really is vital. Without that, it faces the possibility once again of maybe just withering away. That can't be allowed to happen.
Absolutely not. And what we've found that we've developed our online services and involving people, a lot more diversity, a lot more people from abroad actually participating in our online performances. So we have a lot of Uilleann pipers recently from Argentina, Italy, North America, Canada, performing on our series called Piping from the Parlour that's available on our website, pipers.ie. And also what we're doing is we're providing master classes with leading Uilleann pipers, tuition for younger people and even instrument making workshops and reed making. And it's really pulled the whole community around the world together.
And how are you finding the technology as a replacement for the face-to-face interaction?
Yeah, it does present problems, sometimes the time delay and the sound quality isn't great, but the spirit, once people are bought into the idea, it's funny, we're overcoming the technical difficulties. And the people really were fortunate in that we've had a strong online presence for a number of years, so we developed quite a lot of resources. So we were in a good place. And to be honest, Brian, we've really been taken aback and we didn't realise how much appetite there was for the online services. So it's been a really strong, pleasant surprise for us. You know?
And I suppose it's such a unique sound, the Irish pipes. There's nothing quite like it, and it has this enormous international appeal, but it speaks so much of our land and of our history and of our nation.
Absolutely. It's been with us for generations, although in several, over the years, it came perilously close to extinction. And thankfully, it has survived through the work of the likes of Seamus Ennis, Leo Rose, and people like that, Willie Clancy. Mm. So it is a wonderful thing that people still, it's the sound that captivates people and brings people to the instrument. So we're delighted to provide that opportunity. Also, it's what we do year in, year out, added to the development.
We hope very much that we'll be back sitting in the concerts halls or in the pubs or wherever we manage to come across a piper, maintaining and nurturing that wonderful tradition. Thank you for talking to us this morning. That was Gay McKeown from the Irish Society of Irish Pipers. Their website is www.pipers.ie.
The temperatures may be about to drop today, but there is little sign of heavy rains that will reduce the likelihood of a hosepipe ban being introduced, as we were told on this programme yesterday by Irish Water. Dr Tom Collins, the chairperson of Anfora Mishka, the Water Forum, has said it has consistently drawn attention to the lack of resilience in our water services, particularly in Dublin. Professor Fiona Regan is director of the DCU Water Institute and has been keeping a blog on water and water resilience since COVID restrictions started. Professor Regan, good morning.
Good morning.
You've been tracking water levels since about mid-March. What have you found?
Yeah, well, I suppose we knew that we weren't getting the levels of rainfall that would be typical for the time of year. So I just started to look at the data that Met Éireann were showing, and quite quickly, it was clear that the levels were almost 10 times lower than previous 5 years. So kind of for a 30-day period between mid-March, mid-April, we were meeting kind of 5.5 mils of rainfall, where it would have been 10 times that in the previous 5 years.
So do you think that water should have been restricted earlier?
Yes, I do. I think definitely we should have been hearing about these kind of conservation messages clearer 2 months ago. We were getting quite good forecasts. We were knowing that the weather was going to be dry. And certainly with the health issues that we had been facing, we should certainly have been hearing this earlier, yes. Yeah.
But given how much rain we had earlier in the winter, particularly in February, surely there should have been enough supply to keep us going.
Yeah, well, I suppose throughout different parts of the country, the supply varies. And in Dublin, I suppose we have kind of about 1% supply above what we require typically. Now, it's different during this time because businesses are closed and so on. But we're washing our hands a lot more, as we know. So in Dublin, it's quite close to the actual level that we need to supply. In other parts of the country, it could be between 10 and 15%. So it varies very much on where you live. So we can never really take it for granted in the east of the country.
In response, Irish Water say that Dublin needs a new source of water as the existing sources will not be able to meet long-term requirements. And they say they've been consistently clear that the rate of leakage remains unacceptably high and it's a complex issue to solve. Leakage estimated to be at around 40% at the moment. So is it a case of supply being too low or too much still being lost through leaks?
Yes, well, it's really interesting. The Water Advisory Body had a report in March that indicates 45% loss through leakage. This is much too high. And Anfora Mishka, who you referred to earlier, had an independent report done on the Shannon project, which is proposed to alleviate the issue of the East water problem. And they have compared leakage repairs in Dublin, in Ireland, versus three other countries, in Portugal, in Malta, and in Scotland, I think. And the rate of leakage repair in those countries far exceeds the rate at which it is proposed to happen in Ireland. And so I think we need to look at that, because there are technologies that can help us repair those leaks. Now, it's non-trivial, as you say. It's really a huge challenge, and particularly, you know, in a city like Dublin. But we're at a time now where, you know, we're looking at changing how we use transport. And we're going to be digging up, perhaps preparing for cycle lanes. Maybe there's an opportunity to look at ways that we can actually reduce leaks. You know, I think it's a combination of things, you know, reservoir maintenance, reservoir levels, leakage repair has to be a main part of that.
We had one listener who emailed us yesterday when he heard the item about an imminent hose pipe ban, worried about sources of water, for example, pointing to water being used in his area in County Carlow from rivers for extensive irrigation for businesses.
Yeah, well, this is obviously, we're going to see this happening. You know, rivers are a really important supply source for drinking water. So if it's a drinking water supply source that is being used for irrigation, that is a challenge. You know, I think overall, we need a policy that looks at water management and valuing water, and a resilience policy. And I think you mentioned that Tom Collins was referring to that also. I mean, it really needs to be a government-led approach to water management and valuing water. For sure, people are going to be using rivers right now because there's such a drought. This is this year, but this is not going away. 2 years ago, we had a drought. So we need now a call for a management plan for water.
Fiona Regan, Professor Fiona Regan, Director of the DCU Water Institute, thank you very much for speaking to us.
A body representing the country's car dealers has called for the government's planned ban on petrol and diesel car sales to be delayed by 10 years to 2040. It comes after a survey commissioned by the Irish Car Carbon Reduction Alliance found confusion amongst consumers around their new car options. Dennis Murphy is spokesperson for the ICCRA and he joins me on the line now. Dennis, your survey finds confusion about the 2030 fossil fuel car ban, and it's saying it's putting people off buying those kinds of cars now and in the next couple of years. That's bad news, obviously, for car dealers, but from an environmental point of view, it's a good thing, isn't it?
It's not really, Adam, because the confusion, right, has delayed people buying new cars, excuse me. And the route to reducing our emissions in the short term is through more environmentally friendly cars, which are lower petrol and diesel cars. Electric vehicles are coming, and that button has been pushed and it can't be turned off. They're coming, but they won't come until the end of the decade, Adam. And in the meantime, we need,
Well, I mean, tons of CO2 is used in the production of a new car, and that can take years to cancel out with a lower emission vehicle. So often driving your existing car is better than buying a new one.
Well, that's not exactly true now either, Adam, because the car manufacturing plants are moving towards zero emission production as well, which will happen over the coming years. All that's in hand, you know, like these decisions have been taken at a European level about production and the emissions that are produced by these cars. In Ireland, right, we produce 40% more emissions from transport than the average in the European Union. And the reason we do that, right, is that we travel 50% more in kilometres than the European average, right? So if we want to reduce our emissions in the short term, there's only two ways we can do that. Either we stop driving the distance that we're driving, or we drive more fuel-efficient cars. Now, to stop us driving more, right, and the driving that we do, Adam, the vast majority of it is done outside of Dublin City. So it's done in the counties like Monaghan, Longford, Cavan, you know, Westmeath, all of these counties, and you can see where they're driving. They're all driving into Dublin. So unless we change, right, the way that where we live and where we work in the next year or two, we won't be able to reduce emissions. So the way that we've planned our country is causing the emissions. So the only way we can reduce them is by driving more fuel-efficient cars, and they are, in the interim, are petrol and diesel cars.
There is another option, which is public transport and cycling. That should be the real focus in terms of reducing transport
again,
emissions.
But again, Adam, like the most of the transport, right, most of the emissions are caused by driving outside of Dublin. Like, you're not going to have a Lewis in Monaghan. You're not going to have a Lewis in Cavan. You're not going to have a Lewis in Westmeath. You're not going to have
a bus
in the short term. We can have a bus, right? But again, you need density for buses. And there is already a huge public transport, right, by buses between Cork and Dublin, between Galway and Dublin. You see these buses going constantly, they're going day and night. You can't get over the fact, Adam, right, that we drive on average 18,000 kilometres a year. In the European Union, the average is 12,000 kilometres a year. So, like, if you don't recognise that fact, right, that if we want to reduce our emissions, there's two ways. Either we reduce the amount of time that we're spending in the car, or we drive more fuel-efficient cars. In the short term, that's the only way you're going to reduce emissions.
Briefly, I mean, this will put us out of step with a lot of other countries, the UK including, that they've pulled back their target. They're 2035 rather than 2040 now.
But you see, like, it won't, right? Because this is done on the European level. The UK are no longer the European Union. Like, we're a member of the European Union, and there's no ban on internal combustion engines in the European Union. None, right? What the European Union have done, they've banned emissions. So they're on an emissions reduction program, and they don't care how it's produced. So if you reduce emissions through more environmentally friendly internal combustion engines, they don't care, because emissions are getting reduced. And as I said at the outset, this road to zero emission transport has started. And we're only talking about a timeline, right? That's all we're talking about. And in the interim, there's a blended solution. And the blended solution includes internal combustion engine cars, hybrids, and plug-in hybrids. And the Irish government have destroyed consumers' confidence in buying a new car. That's what we're saying. We have the website EWAY 2040. Let people go on that and look for themselves and see what's on there.
Dennis Murphy, spokesperson for the Irish Car Carbon Reduction Alliance. Thank you very much for that. More business news in the next hour. For now, though, it's back to you, Brian.
Let's take a check on the weather prospects. A bit of a change in prospect. Siobhan Ryan is at Met Aran this morning. Good morning, Siobhan.
Good morning, Brian. Well, yes, the recent warm settled spell will be replaced by cooler, changeable and more blustery conditions over the next few days. It does, however, appear as of Sunday our weather will begin to settle down, though. In the short term, we're generally cloudy this morning with a few showers appearing over Leinster. However, sunny spells will begin to develop and overall most areas will be dry today. Feeling fresher than recent days though, in moderate, occasionally fresh northerly breezes. Highest temperatures of 12 to 16 degrees Celsius over Ulster and Connacht and ranging 16 to 19 degrees elsewhere, mildest in the southeast. Now, tonight will hold largely dry, though some showers will arrive into the west and northwest later, and it will be cooler as compared to recent nights, with overnight lows of 5 to 8 degrees Celsius. And then tomorrow Thursday will bring a mix of sunny spells and scattered showers, though most areas will be dry by the evening. Cooler than average tomorrow, with highest temperatures of 12 to 16, maybe 17 degrees Celsius, mildest and driest in the southeast. And tomorrow will be another breezy day with moderate to fresh northwest winds. Following that will Friday, a very similar day following. Sunny spells, scattered blustery showers, again mildest and driest in the southeast. And this coming weekend will Saturday look set to start off dry and mostly sunny for southern counties. However, a band of rain will sink down from the north with cool, wet and breezy weather extending countrywide into the afternoon and evening, and temperatures several degrees below normal there on Saturday, with highest temperatures of just 9 to 13 degrees. That's in a fairly fresh northwest wind. Sunday, though, is looking like it will be the drier, brighter and milder day this weekend, with temperatures of 12 to 18 degrees Celsius. Today, then, in brief, will generally cloudy this morning with a few showers, mainly over Leinster. Brightening up, though, with sunny spells, and overall most areas will be dry today. Feeling fresher than recent times, though, with moderate, occasionally fresh northerly breezes. Highest temperatures of 12 to 16 degrees Celsius over Ulster and Connacht, and ranging a somewhat milder 16 to 19 degrees elsewhere, mildest in the southwest. That's all from me. A very good morning.
You're listening to Morning Ireland on Wednesday, the 3rd of June. The news at 2 minutes past eight is read now by Brian Jennings.
More protests were held overnight in cities across the United States following the death of George Floyd, an unarmed black man who died after being restrained by police in Minneapolis over a week ago. Thousands of people remained on the streets in violation of curfews. But last night's demonstrations were largely peaceful. Earlier, relatives of Mr. Floyd accompanied an estimated 60,000 people on a memorial march through his home city of Houston, Texas. Our Washington correspondent, Brian O'Donovan.
Here in Washington, hundreds of protesters remained outside the White House late into the night in defiance of a 7 p.m. curfew, but the demonstration was largely peaceful. Elsewhere in the U.S. Capitol, members of the National Guard were stationed in front of the iconic Lincoln Memorial as protesters gathered nearby. In New York, demonstrators who crossed a bridge from Brooklyn were blocked from entering Manhattan, while in Atlanta, some protesters threw bottles and aimed fireworks at police as they used tear gas to disperse the crowds. In Los Angeles, meanwhile, a demonstration was held outside the residence of the city's mayor. The US has been gripped by unrest since the killing last week of George Floyd, an unarmed black man who died after being restrained by police in Minneapolis. Brian O'Donovan, RTE News, Washington.
Government formation talks resume today, with negotiators from Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and the Green Party due to return to the question of how to reduce Ireland's greenhouse gas emissions and related financial matters. The three party leaders will hold a separate meeting to review overall progress, with an update also being given to some independent TDs who are evaluating the possibility of joining any new coalition. Last night, the Fine Gael leader Leo Varadkar said a deal may not be reached until next week. Our political correspondent Paul Cunningham.
Both Leo Varadkar and Simon Coveney told their Fine Gael parliamentary party that a successful outcome wasn't guaranteed and core policies like fiscal responsibility had to be in any deal. Sobering was how one TD described it. Yet some progress was reported to have been made in last night's plenary session involving negotiators from all three parties. Sources suggested afterwards they reached full or a significant amount of agreement on texts related to tourism, local government and other subjects. However, far more difficult issues like finance, transport and greenhouse gas emissions are up for discussion today. Separate to those tricky talks, Eamon Ryan, Micheál Martin and Leo Varadkar will meet to review the negotiating process. Some interested independent TDs are due to receive an update on those talks later today and other independent deputies are lined up for tomorrow. The analysis given by Mr. Varadkar to Fine Gael TDs and senators that agreement may not be reached until next week reflects that progress has been slower than expected. However, a Green source suggested that the elongated talks process would ultimately be worth it.
The latest HSE figures show that the overall number of confirmed or suspected coronavirus cases in hospital has increased in the past 24 hours. Yesterday evening, the Department of Health confirmed that a further 8 people diagnosed with COVID-19 have died, bringing the total number of deaths here to 1,658. A further 10 cases were reported, bringing the total number to 25,066. Our health correspondent, Fergal Bowers.
According to new figures from the HSE, there are 422 patients with confirmed or suspected coronavirus in hospital. While the number of confirmed cases has reduced slightly, the increase of 92 overall is accounted for by suspected cases, which are awaiting a test result. The number of patients in intensive care units with confirmed COVID-19 remains stable at 36, and there are now 117 critical care beds vacant in the hospital system. Last night, 10 new cases of the virus were reported by health authorities. The last time the figure was that low was exactly 12 weeks ago.
A judicial review of a decision by the Revenue Commissioners to issue a tax bill of €1.64 billion to pharmaceutical company Perrigo is to begin before the Commercial Court today. The tax assessment, which Revenue is expected to strongly defend, is the second largest in the history of the state after the €13 billion Apple ruling by the European Commission. Our business editor, Will Goodbody.
7 years ago, drug company Elan sold its interest in the intellectual property behind multiple sclerosis drug Tysabri to a partner firm. 8 months after that disposal, in December 2013, another pharmaceutical firm, Perrigo, bought Elan. Revenue subsequently determined there was a tax issue arising from the Tysabri deal and issued Perrigo with a tax bill for underpayment of €1.64 billion in 2018. It claims Perrigo should have been paying tax on royalty payments it continued to receive from the Tysabri deal at the 33% rate for a capital gain, instead of treating it as income and paying 12.5% tax. Today, the Commercial Court will begin a judicial review of that decision. It's expected lawyers for Perrigo will argue that because Elan had calculated its tax in this way for 2 decades without challenge from Revenue, it had a legitimate expectation that the issue should not have been raised. However, Revenue is expected to strongly defend its decision.
Now the time is exactly 8 minutes past 8.
RTE Radio 1 weather with SuperValu. Home cooking is more important than ever lately, so get inspired with thousands of tasty recipes on supervalue.ie.
Generally cloudy this morning with the odd light shower, brightening up, however, with sunny spells developing, overall dry, feeling fresher than recent days in moderate, occasionally fresh northerly breezes. Highest temperatures 12 to 16 degrees across Ulster and Connacht and ranging 16 to 19 degrees elsewhere.
Pádraic Lodge is here again with what it says in the papers.
A report in the Irish Times this morning says Gardaí are investigating Monday's Black Lives Matter protest in Dublin with a view to potentially prosecuting organisers for their role in such a large gathering during the lockdown. According to security and crime editor Conor Lally, a number of people who took on supervisory or organiser roles at the protest were spoken to by Gardaí and had their names and contact details taken. We're told a number of senior officers are aware of plans to hold a similar event this coming Saturday. The paper leads with HSE figures which show that more than 200 people contracted COVID-19 while admitted to hospital for other conditions or treatment. Over 70s will be able to invite people into their homes for the first time in months from next week. That's according to the lead story by Philip Ryan in the Irish Independent. Children and adults will be told they must wear masks and gloves while visiting and stay strictly 2 metres away from the person who is cocooning. The National Public Health Emergency Team is also considering lifting the ban on playgrounds to ease the burden on children. That'll be on condition that the playgrounds are supervised and cleaned regularly. A call for emergency legislation to help Gardaí deal with house parties makes the front page of the Irish Examiner. Residents in Cork City urged the government to act as they protested near UCC yesterday to highlight their concerns after hundreds of young people attended a series of house parties and rented properties in breach of public health guidelines. House parties have become the ultimate sin and can become scenes for the super spread of the virus, so says Eilish O'Regan in The Independent. She writes that the legacy of revelries that were held over the bank holiday weekend may yet be seen in newly diagnosed cases in 2 weeks' time. All talk and no trousers is the headline in the Irish Daily Star's top story. The paper details what it describes as an embarrassing episode involving MEP Luke Ming Flanagan, who appeared on a European Parliament video call in his underwear. He joined the Zoom meeting from his bedroom in Roscommon, saying he just returned from a run and put a shirt on to look respectable. He doesn't appear too concerned, though, commenting, "What's a pair of legs at the end of the day?" On government formation talks, Juno McEnroe in The Examiner reports that the Taoiseach told his parliamentary party last night that if Fianna Fáil and the Green Party do not agree to reduce the state's debts while in coalition, then maybe it's better not to go into government with them. We're told the warning came as the coalition talks hit shaky ground over climate action, pension reforms and transport. All papers cover the heartbreaking scenes in County Mayo yesterday as the body of a 5-year-old boy, Ben Duffy, was recovered from Loch Mask. The Times photograph captures a sombre moment as a hearse leaves the scene with a Garda respectfully observing from the roadside. The Irish News carries condemnation from local representatives and Gardaí of widespread littering of beaches at Inishowen and Donegal over the long weekend, while the Belfast Telegraph reports that there were long queues, happy faces and filled bellies as McDonald's reopened a number of drive-throughs in County Down. Rush hour may soon become a thing of the past. That's according to the Irish Daily Mail's top story. A warning from transport chiefs that travel times to school and work will have to be staggered to minimise the spread of coronavirus. Also in the Mail, we learn that Brown Thomas and Arnott's plan to reopen small format stores next week. BT's plans involve dividing its ground floor spaces and opening the beauty hall and the accessory hall as individual small shops with their own street access. There's coverage too of a jump in the number of injured hedgehogs. The two main causes are an increase in people undertaking garden work with strimmers and foxes losing the easy pickings that came from restaurant bins. And finally, the Irish Daily Mirror gives a two-page spread to the finale last night of the hit drama Normal People. Director Lenny Abrahamson is insisting that there are currently no plans for a second series. "It's the end of the story," he said.
Pádraic, thanks very much indeed for that. There's been a further night of largely peaceful demonstrations in cities across the United States as thousands continue to protest following the killing more than a week ago of African-American man George Floyd in Minneapolis. Some protesters defied curfews to remain on the streets after dark, and there were reports of sporadic violence. Separately, the National Guard in Washington has ordered an investigation into the use of one of its helicopters during Monday's controversial action outside the White House, when peaceful demonstrators were dispersed by riot police. We've been hearing about that and other developments from our Washington correspondent Brian O'Donovan, who began with the latest on the continuing nationwide demonstrations.
Well, here in Washington, hundreds of protesters remained outside the White House until quite late into the night in defiance of a 7 p.m. curfew. But it should be said the demonstration was largely peaceful. Now, I was down at the White House protest again yesterday. More big crowds, but one big difference this time around. A large metal fence has been erected around the White House perimeter to keep protesters back. Now, some of the protesters have been coming to the White House for days. Interestingly, though, some of those who were there yesterday said they were prompted to come down by this heavy-handed tactics that we saw on Monday night when police moved in and cleared the protesters. Now, it has to be said outside the White House, it wasn't all completely peaceful. There was some scenes of people throwing things over that fence at the police officers on the other side, and also people banging on the fence and rattling the fence. Elsewhere in Washington last night, members of the National Guard were stationed in front of the iconic Lincoln Memorial as protesters gathered nearby, and it was quite a striking sight, an almost dystopian image to see these troops in their uniforms lining up the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. Elsewhere outside of Washington, in New York, demonstrators who crossed a bridge from Brooklyn were blocked from entering Manhattan. In Atlanta, some protesters threw bottles and aimed fireworks at police as they used tear gas to disperse the crowds. A demonstration was also held in Los Angeles last night outside the residence of the city's mayor. And in the last hour or two, quite a few arrests have been carried out at that particular demonstration. Now, of course, all of this started following the killing last week of George Floyd, an unarmed black man who died after being restrained by police in Minneapolis. Members of George Floyd's family joined a march yesterday evening. And last night, Roxy Washington, the mother of George Floyd's daughter Gianna, spoke to the media.
I don't have a lot to say because I can't get my words together right now. But I wanted everybody to know that this is what those officers took from me. At the end of the day, they get to go home and be with their families. Gianna does not have a father. He will never see her grow up, graduate. He will never walk down the aisle. If it's a problem she's having and she needs her dad, she does not have that anymore. I'm here for my baby. And I'm here for George because I want justice for him. I want justice for him because he was good. No matter what anybody thinks, he was good. And this is the proof that he was a good man.
Roxy Washington, the mother of George Floyd's daughter. Brian, more details have also emerged in the last number of hours about the moments leading up to that controversial decision to clear protesters from in front of the White House on Monday night. This was before President Trump crossed from the White House to pose for photographs with the Bible in front of St. John's Church.
Yeah, that's right, Brian. The White House very much pushing back against this notion that protesters were cleared just so that Donald Trump could walk across to St. John's Church for a photo opportunity. It's been claimed that the Attorney General William Barr ordered the removal of protesters because he wanted the barrier around the White House to be extended, and that this was a decision that had been taken earlier on in the day. Also, the US Park Police has denied that it used tear gas to clear protesters, saying it was pepper balls and smoke canisters. But it has to be said, Brian, it wasn't just the Park Police that were involved in that process to clear protesters on Monday night. It also involved the National Guard and other police services. The District of Columbia National Guard, now separately, they have set up an investigation into the use of low-flying helicopters to disperse protesters on Monday night. And some quite shocking footage has emerged of helicopters flying extremely low over people, so much so that they were bending trees and breaking branches in a bid to sort of disperse the crowds and get them out of the area. Also as well, still a lot of focus on Donald Trump's emphasis on religion in recent days. As we know, as we mentioned earlier, he held this Bible aloft outside St. John's Episcopal Church. But interestingly, the bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Washington hasn't been too happy about this. The Reverend Marion Budd said that Donald Trump held up the Bible as if it were a prop or an extension of his military and authoritarian position. Yesterday, the president and the first lady visited a shrine to St. John Paul II. That too, however, has been criticised by church leaders. The Catholic Archbishop of Washington, Wilton Gregory, said he was opposed to the visit and said he found it baffling and reprehensible that any Catholic facility would allow itself to be so egregiously misused and manipulated in this way. Yesterday evening, back at the White House, Donald Trump signed an executive order on religious freedom. So what is all this focus on God and religion? Well, I think for Donald Trump, it's about, in times of a crisis, go back to the base. Go back to his base that helped get him elected, which in this case would be conservative Christians. They're the ones that helped get him into the White House 4 years ago, and he is hoping they will help him retain the White House come November.
Latest opinion poll, though, suggests that nationally, presumptive Democrat candidate Joe Biden, Brian, has a lead still in the presidential race. And also separately, some news overnight about the Republican National Convention. That's due to be held, or was due to be held, in North Carolina in August.
That's right, Chair Brian. So this is the Republican National Convention, that big set piece event before the election when Donald Trump would be formally announced as the candidate. Lots of speeches, lots of pomp and ceremony. The Democratic Convention, when Joe Biden will be officially unveiled as the nominee, was due to take place in Milwaukee, Wisconsin in July. That has already been moved to August because of the coronavirus, and Democrats are toying with the idea of having a much more scaled back event because of COVID-19 and because of social distancing. Republicans, however, and Donald Trump in particular, have been very keen not to have their event scaled back in any way. The Republican convention due to take place in Charlotte, North Carolina in late August. But last night, Donald Trump tweeted that he had been forced to find a different state because the governor of North Carolina, who is a Democrat, could not guarantee them that social distancing guidelines would not limit capacity. The North Carolina governor, Roy Cooper, responded by saying that he was committed to having a safe convention, and it was unfortunate that Republicans had never agreed to scale back their event.
Brian O'Donovan speaking to us earlier from Washington.
The deaths of 8 more people from coronavirus have been reported in the last 24 hours here, bringing the current toll to 1,658 people. Health authorities will meet tomorrow to decide whether to recommend a further easing of restrictions on people's movements next week. In the past week, over 20,000 people have been tested for the virus, 98% tested negative, and the director of the National Virus Reference Laboratory, Dr. Killian de Gascon, says the number of people looking for a test through their GP is continuing to fall. Let's speak to Dr. Ilona Duffy. She's a Monaghan-based GP. Dr. Duffy, good morning.
Morning, Gavin.
Tell me about your experience yesterday.
Well, yesterday was an exceptionally busy day for us here in our practice in Monaghan, and probably as busy as some of the days in the early stages of the COVID outbreak when we were seeing, you know, a huge number of calls. And I suppose more of concern for us was that we got 6 positive test results back yesterday. Now, I acknowledge that that's after a weekend as well, but we have another 2 this morning, and that's just on the first checking of the results that are coming into us online.
Why?
Why? Well, it's great news around the country that I think there are 6 counties that have had no positive results in the last week, and that's great, but we're continuing to see positive results here in Monaghan and in Cavan. So why is it happening? I think there are definitely clusters, there are definitely areas that we're seeing outbreaks in, and whereas in the initial stages we saw that was related to nursing homes and hospital settings, now we're seeing it more related to areas of work, so factories, and people have talked about meat factories, but I don't think it's necessarily just meat factories, it's any kind of factory. And I suppose at the moment we know that most of the factories that are open are actually factories relating to food. So I don't think it's related to the food, but I think it is because people are travelling together. They're maybe living together. I think there's still maybe a lack of understanding about the social distancing, especially for people who are travelling together but not living together.
So the patients that you've had confirmed in the last day and the people that you have referred for testing, are they all linked together?
Where we're seeing a number of different groups. We're seeing one group who are definitely linked together, and we're also seeing a group that were being requested to send for testing because they have no GPs. So I think that's another thing that we're seeing from this whole outbreak, how many people are out there who can't access a GP because GP practices are just full, and we know there's been a shortage of them. So we're seeing many people who are kind of ringing saying, well, can you arrange a test for me? If I have symptoms, I'm going to need to go out on sick leave. So you need a GP to arrange the test, and you need a GP to provide you with social welfare cert so that you get some income when you're not allowed work. So that's one group. We are still seeing clusters within families, and I suppose that was one group that we saw yesterday, which is difficult. But I suppose, what's the learning from this? I mean, the good news is we know the numbers are dropping, but the learning really needs to be from these clusters, and how do we prevent this? In the last few weeks, we've definitely seen that amongst factory workers, and a lot of them maybe those with poor English, and that it's difficult for us to communicate with them, and I'm sure it's difficult for public health to communicate and get the message out there about staying home and staying away from others that they live with and other family members. So I think, you know, we need more information about the outbreaks so that we can help handle them, and that's public health and general practice and also employers.
Do you expect more outbreaks as people return to more activity and spend more time with each other?
I think we will, and I don't think that's unexpected. We knew that once we started opening up things and that people started meeting, we would see a rise in cases. But what we've got to be careful is that, as our chief medical officer said, that rise doesn't become a spike and get out of control, because we want to see that R rate, that transferable rate, stay low so that we're not seeing a further peak in cases. So if we can keep the cases low and if we can keep the message out there, I think we need to open up things, and I think there is a plan there for that, but it's got to be done cautiously. And I think we also need to look at other things like the wearing of masks in public, and especially in groups and group settings, especially work settings where people, maybe when they're not on the phone but in an office together, are wearing mouth coverings, because we know there is increasing data that does help reduce the spread.
Before I let you go, Dr. Duffy, how are you? Have you recovered from the virus yet?
Well, I'm fully recovered, thank goodness. It took about 5 weeks to really get back to normal, but I'm great, back at work full time and able to do everything I was beforehand.
That's good to hear. Dr. Ilona Duffy, thank you very much for speaking to us this morning. 27 minutes past eight.
The National Coordination Body for Domestic Abuse Services, Safe Ireland, has agreed an initiative with Boots Chemists to help women experiencing violence in the home during the pandemic. From today, women at risk can find what's been described as a safe space in Boots' 88 pharmacies around the country. Under the initiative, Boots will provide a consultation room in a confidential space where people can contact specialist domestic abuse services. Mary McDermott is CEO, co-CEO of Safe Ireland, and she joins us now. Very good morning, Mary, and thanks for talking to us about this. Perhaps, first of all, you might give us a sense from your own contact with domestic abuse services around the country of how this pandemic is affecting women who are at risk. I know Gardaí are saying there's been something like a 30 or 40% increase in calls to them. Is that reflected in what you're hearing?
Well, yes and no is the answer to that, Ryan. We've been having, Safe Ireland has held twice weekly Zoom meetings since the beginning of the outbreak, and we've had over 30 member organisations from around the country discussing the pressures that have arisen as a result of COVID in that. And what we have met with is, I suppose the simplest way to describe this is the most perfect convergence between the horrific outbreak of COVID and domestic violence. You find yourself in lockdown, effectively under siege, and you're forced then, if you're in an abusive situation, to choose between the threat of the spread of infection or the threat of assault. And so around the country, the pattern that we have seen is that there is a rise in helpline calls in certain areas, and certainly the National Women's Helpline has seen an increase in calls there. With people presenting to refuge for absolute frontline high-risk safety, the patterns are single women, pregnant women, women with toddlers, older women, an increase in rape and sexual assault. They're the kind of profile that have been people that have been presenting. The issue here, sorry, please go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, you're talking there about women who are able to make that call, but I presume this initiative with Boots is designed to address situations in which women are not able to make the call. They don't have access either to a phone, or they can't, if you like, make that cry for help.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The outbreak has reduced women's capacity to reach out and ask for help. Particularly, the reason I gave you that long list of profile there is that what you have is a very definite cohort of women with several small children unable to move. And they are definitely in lockdown. And they also in we have a lot of reports of increased surveillance by abusive partners using technology as well as just straightforward control. And so the ability to make contact is greatly reduced. The Boots Initiative Safe Space is really, it's a complex issue, but it's a really powerful one, because what it's doing for us is for the first time really systematically naming this in a public way and putting the issue into the community. So we're really saying that on the high street this can be discussed. We're trying to address the shame, the stigma and the silence, as well as the fear and the isolation at the moment. So there's a two-hander in this.
And for a woman who wants to avail of the service, how do they go about that?
Well, the first instance is they will go into Boots and the staff there will be able to direct them, importantly, to a local service where they can receive specialist support and advice, and also that they feel safe in themselves just in going in there. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing. They will get their local service, and also then we have the national helplines as well.
And Boots staff presumably have been trained. They have the information to hand. They'll know how to respond if somebody comes in.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. Certainly, Brian. This is very important. We've had long discussions with Boots about this. The staff are not expected to be experts, but we will be supplying training support where people need it. And it's really a question of a conduit to the specialist DV services around the country. That's really the most important thing for us.
And it's operating from today.
And we're very pleased to be working with Boots on it.
Okay, well, thank you for talking to us about it. Mary McDermott from Safe Ireland. Appreciate your time.
Adam Maguire has the business news.
Thanks, Gavin. Drinks Group C&C has reported an operating profit of €120.8 million for the year to the end of February. That's up 14.6%. However, results from the owner of Bulmers and tenants also included exceptional items of €92.5 million, more than half of which directly related to COVID-19. C&C said it has taken a number of mitigation measures relating to the virus, including a full drawdown of its debt and an average salary reduction of 20%. German airline Lufthansa has posted a net loss of €2.1 billion for the first quarter. That was driven by write-downs in the value of some assets, including its fleet and its low-cost Eurowings subsidiary. Lufthansa's non-executive board this week approved a €9 billion bailout from the German government. That will see it take a 20% stake in the airline, while Lufthansa will also be forced to cede some of its prize landing slots to rivals. And Deloitte Ireland has announced the acquisition of cloud services business DNM. Dublin-based DNM works with clients across Europe and North America, as well as offering cloud-based projects. It also advises on the likes of big data and analytics. Finally, the currency markets, 1 euro buying you 89 pence sterling and $1 and 12.2 cent.
The FIFA president Gianni Infantino has urged the German Football Association to use common sense before punishing players who protested about the death of George Floyd on the pitch last weekend. Now, one player, Dortmund's Jadon Sancho, was booked after lifting his jersey to reveal a message on a t-shirt he was wearing underneath. The rules say that players cannot have slogans or statements on their kit. Infantino says the players deserve an applause and not a punishment. Former golf pro Gary Murphy feels the COVID-19 outbreak looks certain to hurt the careers of young Irish male and female golfers. While the top tours plan the restart of their seasons, Murphy has real concerns for those struggling to make a living on the secondary tours. He was speaking to the Game On team last night.
I think it's a really tough place for those young fellas trying to make their way really on the tours, even on the women's golf. You look at, Leona Maguire, her first full season on the LPGA Tour, and she really hasn't played, and getting back into the States is not going to be easy and all of that. But for the players on the mini tours trying to get their way, there'll be no promotion this year onto the European Tour. I don't know if they'll even have any Challenge Tour events. And then you go down the next ladder, and a lot of those young kids who have probably been at it a couple of years might really have to look at, where this is going to take them, because can they afford to hang around for another couple of years and still live that dream? So I think a lot of careers will be lost because of this, which is sad, because, it's not everyone that can go straight onto tour and find a way. Some people it takes them a bit longer, but for those players it's going to be doubly hard, and they're very lucky to have, especially this year, the support of Team Ireland, I would say, for a lot of them, just to keep them afloat more than anything else.
Now, Irish boxing lost one of its great coaches and characters over the weekend following the passing of Michael Chick Gillan. Chick was a champion boxer himself, a barber by day, but best known for his work with young fighters in the city of Galway. He trained dozens and dozens of national champions. He founded the Olympic Boxing Club, which began life in a shipping container. He dedicated his life to building a gym from bricks and mortar, open to kids of all backgrounds, and he eventually came good with that as well. The highlight of his career was training Francis Barrett to become the first traveller to take part in the 1996 Atlanta Olympics.
Obviously, the highlight of your career to date has been representing Ireland at the Olympics in Atlanta. Tell me about what must have been an enormously proud moment for you.
The most proudest moment was when I carried the Irish flag. And then I was so proud. My first fight was in great form, you know, ferocious form. And that was my most proudest moment. And I carried a flag for my country, not because I'm a traveller, I carried it for my country.
The winner from the blue corner. May that miss you. From Ireland, Barrett.
Frank Barrett's rise has been remarkable. And he makes no secret of the debt he owes his trainer, Chick Gillan.
Chick is like a second father to me.
Oh, how are you, Francis? You're welcome. Sit down there, Richard.
He does everything for me, you know. Whenever I go on a trip, he's always worried. There's always, you know, he's always something. There's something in his mind. He always wants me to call him or he call me, whatever. And Chick is real important to me, you know. Very important.
This fella's dreaming about that since he started boxing. Since he started learning or knowing about the Olympic Games, Atlanta, he used to say. One of his good things, his great stamina from training, and you only get that from good hair training. He's down the beach, he goes, makes big hills his target when he's running, does plenty of deep breathing. And all these are the most important things, I says, in any young fella. He doesn't smoke, he doesn't drink. Very seldom he's out after half 10 at night. And he's done that for about 6 years.
And all we want now is we had a fine big gym, just the bare essentials in it, bags, showers, and a ring. We'd have an Olympic champion every 4 years.
Yeah, I've posted some film of Francis training in that old shipping container on Twitter, so check out the RT Sport Twitter account. Irish boxing has come a long, long way. Rest in peace, Chick Gillan.
Government formation, 116 days after the general election, described by those inside and outside the talks as slow. Watching for us, our political correspondent, Paul Cunningham. Anthony Stern, Paul.
Well, yesterday's plenary session was a meeting which I think had to deliver. There was, we know, going to be talks on issues like sports and tourism and education and regional development. Not the issues which some Greens are calling sticky issues, like the scheduled rise in pension age and things like that. From three different sources, Gavin, associated with the talks, progress was made on those less tricky issues, with a considerable amount of text either signed off or due for a minor amendment and therefore expected to be signed off for the next plenary session. Now, with the days rolling on, it's time to secure compromise on the harder issues, I think. I understand that greenhouse gas emissions, one of the key demands of the Green Party, which is arguing for a 7% year-on-year reduction, will be discussed today alongside things like transport and related finance issues. Now, they have kicked this around before several times, so I think at this point in the process, they're going to have to narrow the gaps. Separate to those talks, the three party leaders will also be meeting to review the overall progress, and I think we can expect the leaders to play a far more significant role, because once again, they have to sign off on text. They simply can't keep kicking the can down the road at this point. And the advantage, I guess, of making progress now on trickier issues will give momentum to the talks process, which I think has been lacking up to this point. And also gives the sense that, you know, problems can be overcome, because that's been sorely lacking recently.
What did Leo Varadkar say to the Fine Gael Parliamentary Party meeting last night?
Well, Well, I guess there's sort of different interpretations being placed on the addresses to Fine Gael independent TDs and senators. Simon Coveney, the lead negotiator, and Leo Varadkar, the party leader, were talking. One person felt that Taoiseach was simply telling it as it is. There's no guarantee of success. Fine Gael policies have to feature prominently in any deal, particularly when it comes to finance and agriculture. But two other people I spoke to felt it had introduced the slightest element of doubt, or at least an impression that maybe this deal may not actually come off. One said they felt afterwards maybe it was a means of applying pressure on the other parties. The Fine Gael does need clear wins on those topics, but on the core issues like finance, there was less agreement. You know, there is a sense when it comes to things like finance, you have to pay your debt, otherwise you've no credibility. This is core Fine Gael demand, and what the Taoiseach was saying was just acting on it. So maybe something of a mixed message coming out of the parliamentary party meeting last night, or at least how it was viewed by those who were listening to the two men.
Any clarity emerging on pandemic payments?
Well, we do know that this payment ceases on June the 8th. So a decision has to be taken rather than it being passed on to the next government. Now, one senior TD from Fine Gael said, we can't stop now. And we know that Mr. Varadkar and the Finance Minister, Mr. Donoghue, signalled in the clearest terms that the payment can simply be terminated, given the fact that a massive part of the economy is still in lockdown. However, it is going to be interesting to see how that decision is going to be announced. Will Mr. Varadkar, for example, use it to flag, things that this can't be continued, it has to be tapered off once the economy recovers, because we know there's a political fault line. Then parties like Sinn Féin, like People Before Profit, have been continuously saying you can't cut payments, you have to keep pumping the money out to keep people afloat in these difficult times. So how Mr. Varadkar phrases it, rather than maybe the announcement, will be interesting to see, and whether that triggers off a political battle, or maybe indeed influences some of the government formation talks.
And Paul, tell us about this spreadsheet doing the rounds, predicting that if there was another election this year, that Fine Gael would win an extra 24 seats.
Yeah, this was doing the rounds, was reported by Fiacre Kelly from the Irish Times, although he did say himself that it was a what he described as a bit of a back of the packet of cigarettes analysis. One Fine Gael TD I've spoken to, and I spoke to many who hadn't heard of it, but one TD who had said it was pretty crude and a bit mischievous. But as you say, big gains for Fine Gael, no losses. For Fianna Fáil, 10 seats lost. For the Greens, 8 losses. So what it seems to come from is national polls showing Fine Gael are on the mid 30s, and how that would translate if you were to hold a poll on that basis. There wasn't constituency variations there, and as everyone knows, just because you're riding high in June certainly doesn't mean you're going to be in the same position come September. So I think you take it with a pinch of salt.
Paul, thank you. That's our political correspondent, Paul Cunningham. It's not that long ago since people in many parts of Italy were only allowed to walk up to 200 metres from their home, as authorities there tried to control the spread of COVID-19 infection in a country where over 33,000 people have died in the last 4 months from the virus. Scenes of overwhelmed hospitals, army convoys carrying bodies away from overcrowded mortuaries acted as a warning to many neighbouring European countries of the dangers of the virus. Today, bars, restaurants, churches and hairdressers are open, and from this morning people can travel between regions and into and out of the country. Hugo McCafferty is an Irish journalist based in Italy. He's currently in Lecco in the Lombardy region, that's around 50 kilometres north of Milan. Hugo, good morning again.
Good morning.
It's a while since we've spoken to you. How is life in Lombardy now?
Well, I suppose they lifted the lockdown well over a week ago at this stage, and things seem to be very slowly returning to normal. I can talk about Lombardy because I'm living in this region, and this, of course, was the part that was worst hit. But the other parts of Italy have been relatively unscathed, and you know are currently reporting no new cases. So it does vary from region to region. I think there is definitely a desire to get back to normalcy and to save the summer. The summer is very important economically, but also I think psychologically to a lot of Italians. They've been cooped up, and they want to get out. They want to get to the coast. They want to enjoy living in Italy.
And how are people in Lombardy? Because the region was arguably the worst hit.
Yeah, I think people just get on with it. I think. People are, the main thing is that the numbers are very encouraging, and that the numbers are way down. And even since the lockdown restrictions have been lifted, the numbers have continued to go down. And that's very encouraging. It gives people hope that if they, you know, maintain social distancing, we know that it works, that we can start to get back to some kind of normalcy.
Funerals are now allowed with a maximum of 15 people attending, ideally outdoors. Schools not reopening till September, but tourists are allowed back into Italy from today. Is Lombardy expecting many tourists?
I don't think so. I think the main thing, Lombardy doesn't get that many international tourists, really. I mean, in comparison to the rest of Italy. But I think some regions are wholly dependent on the tourist euro, and they will be desperate for international visitors. Lombardy, of course, is the industrial heartland of the country, and typically the Italian or the Lombardians will be the tourists who will visit the south during the summer. So I think they'll be concentrating more on where they're going to go in the summer.
The head of a hospital, a large hospital in Milan, says the virus is gone from the region.
Yes, this is this doctor is he's well known in the Italian media, and his there are some question marks over his reputation. He's prone to making wild statements. I think there's no evidence to suggest that the virus has lost potency. Yes, the numbers are way down, contagion is way down, death rates are down, ICU numbers are way down, but you know, both the WHO and the country's leading virologists here have said basically there's no there's no weight in that claim at all.
Hugo McCafferty, Irish journalist based in Italy, thank you very much for speaking to us this morning from Lombardy. It's 8:52.
The wild Atlantic Way. So many of us who don't live there are so looking forward to revisiting the West Coast when pandemic restrictions are lifted. But 400 years ago, our Atlantic coast was the graveyard for one of the mightiest military expeditions ever undertaken. In the summer and autumn of 1588, 24 ships of the Spanish Armada were cast up on the storm-bound Irish coast. An estimated 5,000 men lost their lives. Three of those ships were wrecked off Striga Beach in County Sligo. Now, the remarkable story of one of the survivors has been made into a film by a local community group. Hunted by the English army, Captain Francesco de Cuellar spent several months on the run before making his way back to Spain. Our Northwest correspondent Eileen Magner has the story.
My name is Francisco de Cuellar. I believe that you will be astonished at reading this letter to hear that, yes, I remain alive.
I never knew anything about Francisco de Cuellar. I never knew who he was. And then I started to inform myself, to read. When I realized how good this story was, I gotta be playing that role.
The story is a swashbuckling tale of survival, and it deserves a much wider audience. Like, the people in the Northwest know the story, but our Spanish friends, particularly, are engrossed with it when the story is told. So this will give it much wider providence.
Fernando Corral plays Captain Francesco de Cuellar in Armada 1588, a swashbuckling tale as Eddie O'Gorman describes it. Eddie is chair of SpanishArmadaIreland.com, the voluntary group which had the film made to tell the story of the three Armada ships wrecked off Striga in Sligo and the remarkable survival of Captain de Cuellar, whose writings, producer Micheál O'Donnell says, are the basis for the script.
He wrote this script. And we basically tweaked it. You know, we put maybe modern day embellishments and modern technology with his words, but we've stayed pretty faithful to what Francisco de Cuellar wrote. And when you think back at what happened in September 1588, where you have the massive tragedy of up to 1,000 Spanish soldiers and sailors dying here on the beach, and then you take into account the amazing story of the few people who managed to escape, one of whom, Francisco de Cuellar, of course, not only manages to escape from the beach, spends 7 months on the run, trying to avoid capture by the English army, eventually makes his way to freedom, and then writes an entire account about his adventures in Ireland.
The beach offers nothing but destruction and death.
We shot on the actual beach where the wrecks still lie, and the day that we shot the shipwreck was an absolutely incredible storm. So we were blessed with about an enormous amount of special effects that weren't special, they were real effects on it. So it gave an extra poignancy.
And on the fifth day, there's sprang up so great a storm on the wind.
Lynn Williams was the production designer on the film, in which production company Mediacoop worked alongside many local people in Strija and Grange, a community which has been commemorating the 1,000 men lost in 1588 for many years now. They've opened a small Armada museum in Grange and in 2015 witnessed the raising of 9 Spanish cannon from the seabed. Eddie says that by making the film, they want to promote their ultimate goal of a proper Armada centre in Grange.
They are a treasure, but of course we must get them back for display in the local community. This film will be very much a part of that progress. The next step is a feasibility study to build a greenfield site to accommodate all the artefacts that are already recovered, and particularly those that will be recovered over the next 10-15 years, because this is an active archaeological site under the protection of the National Monument Service. And we have the council and we have the national government on board with regard to that. Fáilte Ireland are very supportive of our project.
I write to tell you of the hardships and misfortunes I have endured since the Armada set sail from Lisbon for England.
It's an incredible story, and I would recommend that people look at it, whether you look at the English version or the Spanish version, because we have both. They're both available for download, and you can make up your own minds. But it's an amazing story, and I think it'll bring this part of the Spanish Armada and its connection with Sligo to a much broader audience.
Bring word of this tale to the right ears, that I might return with honour to Spain, and that my service to the king might be restored.
The words of Francisco de Cuellar ending that report from Eileen Magner. The film is available to download from SpanishArmadaIreland.com. It'll cost you €5. All the proceeds will be reinvested in that plan for a Spanish Armada visitor centre. And you can hear more about the story of the film on Nationwide tonight on RTE1 at 7 p.m.